strange, but grace does wonderful things. Thirdly, family. Here again, the religious must be trained to find satisfaction not only, and in fact, not as such, in domestic family life, but in living for a lifetime in a religious community. The difference between living in a domestic family and living in a community is the difference between nature and grace. No doubt even to live in the family peaceably takes some grace. But I hope you agree with me. It takes a lot of grace and special grace to live for a lifetime in a community. And finally, companionship. Here again, the natural desire for companionship with others, especially for members of the opposite sex, there must be training in sacrificing such companionship by living with persons of the same sex. It does take special grace, special training, and in a religious community of women, they should be told, well, you've never lived this way before. I, who didn't have either brothers or sisters before I entered the Jesuit, I found it quite an experience. I enjoyed it. Almost naturally, it was a compensation for what I had missed for so many years. Well, then I proceeded to dominate my fellow novices. I think I told you, after a couple of months, I was called in and told, you're an intellectual bully. Either you learn some humility to live with others, or in 1 month I'll send you home. Nobody has to tell me you need a lot of grace to live with others in a lifelong companionship and of the same sex. And here is no apologies for saying it. All psychologists agree, and spiritual writers concur, and between men living in a man's community and women living in a women's community, it is more of a sacrifice for women. In any case, training certain things that, because you are living among people of your own gender, there are certain things you do and certain things you don't do. There are certain patterns of behavior. The subject we are here treating is not only good for one lecture, this is good for a course. But we're just stating certain broad principles before we finally get down to the means. What are we talking about? I here want to surface a dozen means that should be used. Some are obvious, some are less obvious. Some you can find in books, some you learn only from priestly experience. First, these are not exactly in the order of importance, though I suppose things that first come to mind maybe are more important. First, clear faith conviction that a life of consecrated chastity is pleasing to God. Clear faith conviction that a lifetime commitment to consecrated chastity is pleasing to God. I underline the word faith. In fact, it's the only underlined word in all my notes. Faith. Reason cannot prove it. That's why the stronger the faith of a person, the more likely he or she is to live this lifetime commitment and the word is correct, faith fully. All the reasons that can be conjured up should be brought up. Normally, when people enter the religious community, they are still infants in the spiritual life. There are exceptions, but they are exceptions. And the infancy is not so much in strength, but mainly in knowledge. There are two qualities of infancy. Both pertain here. One is weakness, the other is ignorance. And here is especially ignorance. Oh, how the young religious must be told the facts, and the facts not only of sex, but the facts of chastity. And being told these are things you cannot prove from reason. You must believe. Now, under this number one, I have three sub-means. How to cultivate this clear faith. First, through prayer. I know of no exceptions. I've never met one. Only prayerful people can even practice the chastity of temperance and much more, the chastity of sacrifice. Without prayer, constant cultivated union with God, chastity, certainly consecrated chastity, is impossible. The young religious must see the logic between the two. And here's the way it goes. Without grace, chastity is impossible. Without prayer, grace will not be received. Either you pray and you get the grace, or you don't observe chastity. Secondly, study. Study not as sex education, but study as chastity education. Understanding what it means. Maybe I told you, sometime last fall, two men came to visit me in Manhattan. I knew the one before, I hadn't met the other. And they thought they wanted to take, I tell you this, a vow of chastity. So we talked before they were going to take their vow. Both mature men. They thought they were going to take a vow to keep the 6th to 9th commandment. There are times when my naturally triggered temper tends to explode. I couldn't believe it. So I proceeded to enlighten them. Study. Took 5 minutes. A vow of chastity means a sacrifice of marriage. You don't, in your bursting generosity, tell God, Lord, I know you don't have it coming, but I'm going to be chaste. I'm not going to sin against the 6th to 9th commandment. That's almost blasphemy. So study. What chastity is, how it was practiced by the great men and women of church history, and how I am to put it into practice. And third, and this is where you and others like you come in, counsel. Other virtues can be developed. Other aspects of the religious life can grow, but not chastity without counsel. Either the person gets counsel, or sure as they're human, They're going to do stupid things, make mistakes, get themselves into situations which they cannot cope with, blindly and blindly, and there is nobody so foolish as an unenlightened religious. That's why some religious, now who have become, as the expression goes, liberated, say in secular clothes, you watch their behavior, you want to weep. Any woman their age, with just a grammar school education, would know better. You just don't say or do certain things. You just don't. So counsel. And the counsel must be, I would say, lifelong. But certainly in the early years of formation. Counsel on how to cope with the practice of chastity at the age at which they are and how to cope with it in the years to come. Second recommended means, openness. Openness with one's confessor, with superiors, with those who are in charge of the one in formation. The masters of the spiritual life say that the evil spirit deceives religious in no area more frequently than in this, by urging them to the practice of, well, a mistaken or misplaced confidence or humility, which becomes prudery by not talking about certain things they simply should tell those who are in position under God to help them. Openness. This requires great delicacy. Some, as you know, are, if anything, too open. And they've got to be told, too, thanks, I don't need to hear that. And again, since we're dealing with this subject between men and women, women tend to be more restrained and reluctant than men. That should be known. They can talk for several hours about this subject and never really tell you all that, say, is bothering them. Third recommended means, the knowledge of one's own, and I've got three parts, one's own weaknesses in this matter, one's needs in this matter, and one's stimuli in this area. The importance of knowing one's own weaknesses, needs, and stimuli. A word about each. How does a person know what his or her weakness is in this matter? The easiest way is past experience. To know that if I've had troubles along this line in the past, the odds are I have a weakness here that needs to be specially looked into and controlled. But not only. It's not only the past, because there are, thank God, not a few religious who enter, even today, a religious institute who have not had, as we say, a past. And therefore the past is no great help, because it looks like they've got this thing in command. Be sure to help them to recognize that this is the difficult commandment for everyone. Let me just point out some signs of weakness, either actual, as shown from past experience, or potential, into the future. Certain temperaments and personality. I have more of a weakness here than others. Speaking in general, the more cold, uncommunicative personality will have less trouble than one who is more bubbling and, as we say, sanguine. The risk with people who have a bubbling temperament is they're liable to bubble with the wrong people at the wrong time, and especially with religious women. I've watched some of them, and in most cases I can't do anything except pray. The way some of them behave, holy innocence, wide open. Oh no, sister. Oh no. Don't talk that way. Don't act that way. Don't say that. Especially say in the company of men. And whatever else religious women must know is how easily men are aroused. And how easily they will misunderstand the maybe innocent conduct of a woman in their presence. She doesn't think she's speaking or acting seductively, but she is. The main single reason for the massive loss in the priesthood and the religious life in our country is right here. And this is especially when religious women are dealing with priests. So certain types of temperament have moral weakness. How much we tell other people. There are those with whom we can be very confidential. With others, we had better be very reticent. Again, weaknesses can come from one's past training. Now, this is not to play the psychologist as a counselor. But certain people with a certain kind of home upbringing have more of a weakness than others. For example, a father who was seldom home. This affects especially the daughters. Because a balanced relationship between daughter and father is on the natural level the best single preparation for living a lifetime of consecrated chastity. And with men, a balanced relationship with one's mother. Now there is love, but the love which does not take advantage of the other person. Secondly, the knowledge of one's needs. Now here, we do not speak of the needs on the level of venereal pleasure. That must simply be given up, period. It is either total abstinence or it is not consecrated chastity. In spite of some of the nonsense that I'm sure you've heard or maybe even read that is being peddled these days. Total abstinence, here's the church's teaching, it is Christ's teaching, anything else is a lie as regards venereal pleasure. But the needs refer rather to the others. Take, for example, the need, which is a natural one, for parenthood, that in my exercise of the spiritual or supernatural parenthood, to which we both have a right, and which in the imitation of Christ we are to practice, there are some people for whom, for example, dealing a great deal with children, especially in certain circumstances, may be a threat to their chastity. Because even though they may not sin overtly by indulging in illicit sexual pleasure, they may get satisfaction vicariously in dealing with children, forgetting that in dealing with children, the most important thing I think to remember is that you most show your love for them not by contacting or touching them physically, but by contacting and touching them spiritually. And what holds true for children applies also to adults, especially of the opposite sex. And we who have not had the experience of physical fatherhood or motherhood may not realize there's such a thing as a child growing up. And a child grows up when it becomes weaned from the mother. Do you know what I'm saying? And the physical dependence, though it may still be there, becomes less in favor of a psychological and spiritual dependence. So that the dealing with others, this is a need. We need others to need us. And here the most fundamental need, of course, is we naturally need children, but supernaturally, to realize that some people must sacrifice dealing with children because it's such a risk. But even when they deal with children, well, again I repeat that people particularly of the opposite sex, the need that others may have of me that I want to show is that much more perfect, as it is less physical and bodily. And finally, stimuli. To know my own sexual stimuli. I have given whole conferences on not just this one subject. With rare exception, the sexual impulse is aroused by stimulus from the outside. What we read, what we see, what we touch, what we hear is what first mildly and then imperiously arouses the sex urge. No two people here are the same. They're not the same because of their personality, their temperament, their experience, their past habits. No two are the same. Some, and this is what you have to teach them, know how much you can take, and in God's name, don't expose yourself unnecessarily to any more. One of the finest passages here, and I think it's worth, it'll take 15 seconds to find it. It's the end of the Gospel of St. Mark. at the end of his gospel, Mark quotes the Savior, "These signs shall follow them that believe. In my name they shall cast out devils, they shall speak with new tongues, they shall take up serpents, and if they shall drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them." That's chapter 16, verses 17 and 18. As long as, but let's be sure that it is verified, what we are doing, the stimuli to which we are exposed, are according to the will of God and consistent with my vocation, no matter how deadly the thing may be, it will not hurt us. But it is awfully important to think, to know of what for me would be a deadly thing. That some people, they must early in their spiritual life, and the earlier the better, be told, "Sorry, dear, but you will have to give up a lot of things in your religious life that your fellow religious may legitimately enjoy and experience." Reading, looking, contact with people in so many ways. I've learned many things in the priesthood. This is one. Know your sex stimuli, and in God's name, don't tempt God by foolishly going beyond what you can do, and if it means sometimes embarrassment, if it means maybe a lifetime of not enjoying what the person right next to you may legitimately possess and experience, so be it. Fourth, and with this we'll close because it'll be time, sustained motivation. The Church in her wisdom is now telling religious and is urging all chapters to provide for this, what is called continuing formation. Of all the areas in which continuing formation is needed, it is especially needed here that religious vow to consecrated chastity sustain their motivation. Why does it have to be sustained? Because situations change. The work I'm doing will be different. And especially from the early years of formation, where the occasion for sex stimulation and temptation may be minimized in dealing with others in the apostolate, the gates are often wide open. And when, for example, I discover maybe for the first time in my life the attractiveness of the opposite sex, or when I see, as I may well, happy, beautiful family whose children I am teaching, I must be motivated. 10, 20 years after I've taken my vow, and tell the Lord, "Lord, I know it's beautiful, but I've given that up for love of you." And I must then and there have a reason for my sacrifice. And I think, brother?
I have a question on that very thing. If I was, suppose, put in charge of a house with religious who have been in vows, say, 10 years or something, and do I have a right and obligation as superior to conduct, say, formal classes
I would say not only the right, but the duty. Now, evidently, depending on the size of the community and the problems that may be inherent, prudence in this matter always is important. And one of the rules of prudence in teaching about chastity is that in general, it is better to do privately rather than, though it would save time, to do it together. Because what you may say can help one person and just possibly arouse another. But yes, they should be told and taught. And this is one area that I think a superior should be especially aware of and watch the behavioral patterns of the religious under his or her care, and then tell them quietly, calmly. And in some case, it may be that an immediate change of position may be the only solution to be removed from situations that are simply more than that person can take. It is time. Shall we close with a prayer?